The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hi, this is Mike Edwards with another edition of the Armchair Traveler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. And over the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic Traveler and AAA Go Magazine. Well, our first episode of Armchair Traveler for 2018 is going to be an article from the Best of the World, Where to Go in 2018, published in the December 2017, January 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. Now, as we learned in last week's episode, the editors have chosen 21 locations, with 7 for Best of Culture, 7 for Best of City Life, and 7 for Best for Nature. On last week's Armchair Traveler, we featured those selected best for culture. That included Harare, Ethiopia, Friesland, Netherlands, Cleveland, Ohio, Vienna, Austria, Tetuan, Morocco, Labrador, Canada, and Oaxaca, Mexico. As those who joined us will recall, we made brief visits to the first 6 locations, then we spent some time learning about the art of dye-making in Oaxaca. Now, the editors are going to follow a similar format today as we explore 7 places chosen best for city life. And our first stop is Tbilisi, Georgia, not the Georgia in the United States, but the one located in Asia. Leading our tour in the first 6 locations are writers Mary Ellen Kennedy Duckett and Alexandra Petrie. So let us begin. Tbilisi, Georgia. And why go now? Well, discover a modern marvel. Riding out Persian, Arab, Byzantine, Ottoman, Russian, and then Soviet occupations over its 1,500-year history, has imbued Georgia's resilient capital city with an eclectic, make-do aesthetic. Cafes and tea houses in Old Tbilisi are secreted behind cracked facades and centuries-old courtyard walls. In tree-lined Vera, adaptive reuses such as Chic Room Hotel Tbilisi, a former publishing house, welcome the new while preserving the old. Rampant redevelopment, however, is creating rising seas of glass towers and reshaping the cityscape at a dizzying pace. Walk the cobblestone lanes of disarmingly disorganized Old Tbilisi now to experience the city's charms. The 24-hour sulfur baths, the plumped Kinkali spiced meat dumplings, and the legendary hospitality of the locals. So there you go in Tbilisi. Sounds like an interesting trip. And that takes us to our next stop, which is Phnom Penh, Cambodia. And why should we go now? Explore a kinetic capital of Khmer culture. Phnom Penh plays a leading role in director Angelina Jolie's latest film, First They Killed My Father, Cambodia's foreign language submission for the 90th Academy Awards. Oscar buzz for the Cambodian genocide drama is boosting interest in all things Khmer. Visit the kingdom's capital city for a full-century deep dive into Cambodian urban life, a chaotic mix of hip retailers and restaurants, French colonial architecture, and Khmer history and culture. Observe the spectacle from the Rosewood Phnom Penh, the city's tallest luxury hotel. Set to open in late 2017, the posh pad occupies the top 14 floors of Phnom Penh's tallest skyscraper, 617-foot Phadanak Capital Tower 1. Discover Khmer cultural treasures in the Royal Palace compound, home of the ornate silver pagoda Wat Pre Kiel and its life-size gold Buddha. Then learn about the Khmer Rouge Reign of Terror in the harrowing Tuang Slang Genocide Museum. And on to Sydney, Australia for our next stop, and why go now? Applaud an urban icon. The iconic sails of Sydney's Opera House remain as dazzlingly white as ever, but inside the performance venue, major changes are debuting. A $273 million upgrade launched in May includes state-of-the-art acoustics, a hangout-friendly foyer, and other improvements that will make a night at the opera a showstopper both on stage and off. The first phase of the renovation wraps up in December with the reopening of the Joan Sutherland Theater, the building's second-largest performance space, where programs include the return of the Australian Ballet in 2018. After the show, enjoy a glass of Hunter Valley Shiraz at the Opera Bar and watch boats come in and out of the harbor, a scene worthy of its own ovation. And we move now back to the U.S., San Antonio, Texas. And why go now? Well, it's party like it's 1718, yeah. The Alamo isn't the only thing to remember about San Antonio. The South Central Texas city lassos 3 centuries of history, reason enough to throw a biggest Texas tricentennial celebration. Kicking off the year-long fiesta are an epic New Year's Eve concert and fireworks extravaganza. We just missed that by 24 hours, didn't we? More than 550 arts and cultural events follow in 2018, most highlighting San Antonio's confluence of cultures, including indigenous Canary Islander, Spanish, Mexican, and German. I find it fascinating when people come together to make cities. That is the nature of San Antonio, says 2013 Texas Poet Laureate Rosemary Catacolas, who is curating Forgotten Histories of San Antonio for a tricentennial story wall. It has been a completely international and intercultural city from the beginning to now, she says. And from here, we go to Santiago, Chile. And why go now? Well, discover South America's spiciest new art scene. In Chile's capital and largest city, buildings are fair game for vivid graffiti. Santiago's recent history since the 60s is expressed on its walls through the use of color and style, says Al Ramirez, founder of the city's Cinco Street Art Tours, and that's spelled S-T-G-O. It's a shortened version of Santiago, or you can say Santiago. Anyway, its top neighborhood galleries for walking tours include Bohemian Bella Vista, as well as Brazil, Unge, hotbeds of the Chilean style street art known as BRP, Brigada Ramona Parra. In long-neglected San Miguel, see how an open-air mural museum is inspiring community revitalization, adds Ramirez. Many people can visit Santiago and see only the historical sites and viewpoints from the top of pretty buildings. Street art is perfect for people who love to soak in the local culture and understand what Chile is really like. And that takes us to our next stop, which is going to be Malmö, Sweden. Now, introducing this article, there's a little special headline that reads, Swedish design studio Vanguard recently converted an abandoned freight depot to house Malmö Market Hall. Food stalls and cafes include Favo Glass for ice cream, Palms for sandwiches, and Holy Greens for salads. And so why go now to Malmö, Sweden? Well, taste global flavor at a Swedish smorgasbord. Backed by fertile Skåne province, farmland, and home to nearly 180 nationalities and more than 700 restaurants, Malmö is a United Nations of food. Copenhagen considers Skåne its own kitchen garden, says Tete Vostrom, Sweden's first female chef to earn a Michelin star when she headed the kitchen at Bloom in the Park. We do have strong influences from the Danish capital with its cutting-edge Nordic cuisine, but this doesn't limit the variation in creativity in Malmö food, she notes. Case in point, traditional Scandinavian agagaga and egg pancakes served with smoked bacon and lingonberries remains a local favorite, but the number one street food is falafel. So there you go. Well, before we continue, I want to spend a line or two on Skåne, spelled S-K-A-N-E, but pronounced, you can say Skåne or Skåne. And being of Swedish ancestry and from learning about our family history, I've learned that our forebears resided in Skåne, one of two places. The other one is called Småland. So if you head to Malmö, Sweden, I want you to say hi to my Svensson cousins, okay? Well, now it's time to linger as we enjoy our seventh stop in the Best for City Life. This is going to be Dublin, Lucky and Charmed, and written by Paul O'Connelly. Okay? And this is going to take a look at Dublin, Ireland, and befriending the locals in the world's cheeriest city is the lead-in subhead. And we begin with, would you like to hear a song in Irish? P.J. Murphy sometimes surprises visitors with this question. Of course, they can't refuse, he tells me. We're in Swaney's, a Dublin pharmacy that features in James Joyce's Ulysses, smell almost cure you like the dentist doorbell, as Leopold Bloom muses. It's no longer a working apothecary, but the mahogany shelves and woody whiff of books make me feel like I've stepped over a cordon into a museum exhibit. Murphy is one of the volunteers, entertaining visitors with lunchtime readings, freewheeling chats, and alarmingly forensic references to Joyce. He'd talk the hind legs off a donkey. That's the author's comments, not mine. If you open that book there on page 151, you'll find the third verse of The Lass of Aughrim, Murphy says, pointing out a copy of Dubliners to an Austrian couple who stumble into the time capsule. I'm going to sing it for you now. And he does, whipping out a guitar that he says was left behind by an Italian student. Everything has a story in Swinis. With his bow tie, lab coat, and Einsteinian explosion of hair, Murphy is part mad scientist, part literary professor. But he's all Dublin. As we banter, another visitor drops by, an American woman browsing for a literary souvenir. She settles on a diary with an image of Joyce's masterpiece as its cover. You can write your own Ulysses, Murphy grins. Well, call it a Dublin minute. One moment, I'm walking from the train station toward town, a route I've taken 1,000 times. And the next, I'm in a short story. What is it about this city? I was born in Dublin. I work here. I've lived here. I regularly curse its winter grayness and lopsided development, its choking traffic and soaring rents. But then the magic happens. I want to find out if this really is the friendliest city in the world, as so many tourists say it is. And if so, what strange chemistry makes it that way? Dublin's charm isn't breaking news, of course. The path between Guinness, Trinity College, and the Book of Kells is well worn. But its secret lies in the spaces between. I've known that since I was a student here, writing stories and playing in bands and squandering food money on Friday nights. Cleveland, too, by the River Liffey, and with a juicy north-side-south-side rivalry. Ireland's capital is an intimate and wonderfully walkable puzzle. What do you know about Irish food? Asked Ketty quickly. Sheltering from spits of rain under the portico of the General Post Office, she is kicking off another delicious Dublin food tour. Stew and tomatoes, someone ventures. A generation ago, perhaps, when I was growing up, Irish cuisine didn't exist beyond dishes like bacon and cabbage. As in most other Catholic households, fish was for Fridays and fine mint French dining. Now we've realized the quality of Irish ingredients, from mouth-watering cheeses to smoked fish and mountain lamb, and we're not afraid to have fun with them. Just try a scoop of the caramelized brown bread ice cream at Murphy's, for example. A new wave of chefs, restaurants, and entrepreneurs is creating casual spaces that click. Our island nation is also finally embracing its seafood. Before, you couldn't get fish in this country without having a white tablecloth rolled out in front of you, says Niall Sabagon, owner of Clawpook, a new seafood joint on Capel Street that serves the trendy raw fish salad. On Quigley's tour, I knock back a tart and punchy brew at Vice Coffee Incorporated. We taste Irish chocolates at Coco Atier, and fresh scones at Camarino Bakery, and streaming trays of fish and chips at Super Miss Sue. Like so much else with this city, however, food proves a mere entry point, an excuse to pull at every conversational thread we encounter along the way. Quigley is French, she tells us. She moved here from the Loire Valley about 12 years ago. I fell in love with an Irishman, she says, so I stayed. I'm reminded of the standard Dublin greeting. What's the story? You don't have to answer. You can toss it back. Not much story with you? Or you can get dishing. Wait till I tell you. Often shortened to a single word, story. It evokes the city's literary chops, but also casual, off-the-cuff creativity that lifts good conversation. There's an Irish word, sarai, which describes the flourishes and stylish additional details in storytelling, as translated by Turak O. Siga. Now, he is the author of Mother Flecklier, Dispatches from a Not-So-Dead Language. The details are the reason that two people tell a story, but one tells it better. Case in point, the football player is tired, A, and then there's B. He'd given it everything. He could barely run the length of himself. Dublin is a place where everyone is said to have a novel in them, if only they'd go home and write it. Remember the financial crisis of 07 and 08? Well, I do. That's when my wife and I bought our house. I'm scared to look at the bank statements. Recession spiked the city like a football, but it's bouncing back. 5 or 6 years ago, everybody was afraid to say they were doing well. Clawpoke's Sabonia tells me they put their head down, but we're out of the slump, onward looking. It's not only the change. Ireland has voted to legalize same-sex marriage. Leo Varadkar has become its first gay Taoiseach prime minister. In Dublin, the high-tech Irish Immigration Museum, EPIC, has opened in the Docklands. The National Gallery shows off a $35 million revamp. The Lewis Cross City Tram launches soon, and a U2 museum may one day rock the city. Ireland's capital is having a moment. At Meet Me in the Morning on Pleasant Street, I wolf down a bowl of eggs and greens built on leaves, artisan bread, and cubeen chorizo. It feels like a reboot of the Irish breakfast, Heron and Gray. The city's newest Michelin-starred restaurant is a 24-seater shoehorned into a car trunk-sized Black Rock market. Fishy Fridays, try organic rope mussels at Fish Shop on Brinberb Street. Something's cooking all right. Downsides, there's a plague of gourmet burgers and New York-style eateries and donuts. God, Dublin really hit high peak donut. Is it yourself? Walking along South Ann Street, I bump into a colleague. He's in a chipper mood, breezing by with a leather satchel slung over a pink T-shirt, orange sneakers, and khaki shorts. It's June, and the sun is splitting stones. He gestures to his outfit. I just said, "Fuck it," he says. The rest of them are outside Keogh's if you want to pop over for a pint. It's 4:30 on a Wednesday afternoon. I'm sorely tempted. Back in the day, I wouldn't have thought twice. Keogh's a warren of snugs, bars, and living rooms crammed into a Victorian house. It's a rabbit hole. Go down there and you never know when you'll come out. Sorry, I say, taking a rain check. You're grand. Sorry, grand? The salt and pepper of our sentences. I push on, musing on the malleability of Iberno-English. In Ireland, sorry can mean excuse me, may I have your attention, or occasionally sorry grand means okay, not bad, or that's fine. It does not mean great or magnificent. We don't do direct here or literal. We talk around topics, not through them. We're embarrassed by compliments. We love casually devastating takedowns. She's big boned. We drive English like we stole it. Well, the Irish are something else, huh? Well, let's go on. I meet Joe Landy, a retired farmer who volunteers with the Little Museum of Dublin City of a Thousand Welcomes initiative and the Porterhouse Bar. Ambassadors like him take tourists for a pint or a cuppa to answer basic questions like, what's it like to drive on the left? What exactly happened in 1916? But mostly they just chat. I was with one couple about 2 weeks, Landy says, and the guy told me, I want to retire to this country. I said, have you ever spent a winter here? The guy said he had, but that it has nothing to do with the weather. I said, well, what is it then? He said, the people. Visitors just can't believe Dublin's friendliness, Landy says. Dubliners are not Disneyland cast members, but their chemistry with visitors, the mix of Celtic charm and Mediterranean warmth, well, it can turn even the hardest of hearts to putty. My encounter with Landy reminds me of a slogan on one of the museum's T-shirts, Dublin, Europe's largest village. It's true. Some 1.3 million people live in this city, yet I always meet someone I know. Walks take me from Georgian squares to the European headquarters of Facebook and Google, but streets feel as familiar and overlapping as the lines on my hand. In the Liberties, a historic working-class neighborhood, I pass pubs and Catholic churches and street vendors selling from prams. The smell of coffee seeps from a hipster cafe. At the rebooted Teeling Whiskey Distillery, hashtags are stamped on barrels. Copper vats are shining like exotic fruit. In its cafe, a construction worker sits next to me with white headphones on and a paperback in his lap. A cushion between us is embellished with a paraphrase of James Joyce, the light music of whiskey falling into a glass, an agreeable interlude. I wonder what P.J. Murphy at Sweeney's would think. At the Powers Court Center, a boutique shopping mall off South William Street, I linger in the concept store atrium. Years ago, I bought a pair of earrings here for my wife. We'd just been through the stress of replacing a nanny, or rather she had, and I wanted to get her a gift. I found it in a pair of earrings the designer Cheppy Sweetman had cast from a swan feather collected along the Royal Canal. A block away, Grafton Street is bloated with international brands. Here, I smile when I see the familiar swan feather earrings next to new local goods ranging from Jill DeBurka's hand-embroidered textiles to Pearl Reddington's hot takes on knitwear. There's a svelte young shop assistant on duty with a rustle of raven hair and jet black T-shirt. I ask after some of Reddington's pieces. That's me, she beams. The 23-year-old is gearing up to stock her first collection. She tells me, using Donegal yarns and a color story of navy, blues, grays, and neon yellows. Right now, she's trying to boost her fledgling label. I pull up her Instagram on my phone, and together we flick through her twist on the traditional Irish Ginsey sweater. Not long ago, Irish design seemed like it was reserved for museums and duty-free stores. Now it feels like a living thing. There's only one place for me to wrap up my walks. I've had a flea in my ear about Keogh's ever since that chance meeting on South Ann Street. Now it's Saturday, the stars have aligned, and I squeeze in through a side door. A sing-song is underway in the upstairs lounge. The woods are worn, the wallpaper waxy, and sash windows let cool air in from the street. My friends have already arrived and are cradling glasses. Hiya, hiya, bollocks! I smile, feeling a little yip of endorphins. Nobody's sorry. Everything's grand. The ribbing has started, and we're rolling back the years. I think that, yes, in moments like these, Dublin might just be the friendliest city in the world. Tomorrow morning, I'll be cynical. We all will. But right now, Dublin isn't a place. It's a state of mind. Well, our resident Dublin guide, Paul O'Conholly, is a travel writer and author of a book, Secret Dublin, An Unusual Guide. And accompanying his article are some tips, headline Travel-Wise Dublin, in case you'd like to visit or know more about the Irish capital. So let's learn. Three city walks day to night. Morning mosey. Scratched that selfie itch at Trinity College before walking west down Temple Bar from Anglesey Street. Skip the pubs here for the independent stores such as the Gutter Bookshop, Seopala, or Indigo and Cloth, following Essex Street all the way to Fish Amble Street, where Handel's Messiah was first performed in 1742. Loop back to cross Groton Bridge into Capel Street, opting for soup and contemporary art at Mish, or Mishmash, I should say, or brunch with a Middle Eastern twist at Brother Hubbard North. Then we have an afternoon amble. Grab a tour and a taster at Teeling Distillery, the craft whiskey hub in Newmarket. From there, it's a 10-minute stroll to St. Patrick's Cathedral, where you'll find time-worn tombs and treasures like Jonathan Swift's Death Mass. Continue east toward Ongear Street, refueling with a takeout slice at Dublin Pizzas Company or a donut at Ongear Danger. Or Injure Danger, I think is how they pronounce it locally. And then we take an evening stroll. Start with a pint of Guinness at the old school Toner's on Bagot Street. Take a deep dive into contemporary Irish food at the deceptively simple Ito, followed by a dash of classic Dublin glam at the Shelburne Hotel's Horseshoe Bar. Afterward, let your hair down on grungy Wexford Street, stopping in against the grain for Irish craft beers and Whalen's for live music. Now, what about where to stay? Well, the Dean. When it opened in 2014, the Dean gave Dublin's boutique hotel scene a kick in the backside. Some amenities feel a bit gimmicky. We're looking at you, many smeg fridges. But bold splashes of contemporary Irish art and expansive views from Sophie's rooftop bar are the real deal. And if you want to know more about Dean, or the Dean as they call it, it's deandublin.ie, D-E-A-N, deandublin.ie online. Then we have the Westbury. Run by the family-owned Doyle Collection, this grand dame near Grafton Street embellishes five-star opulence with local touches like an Irish afternoon tea, custom-woven wool carpets, and the Urbane New Brasserie Bathus. And you can learn more at doylecollection.com, D-O-Y-L-E, doylecollection.com. And then another place to stay is called Number 31, a hidden doorway on Leeson Close leads to one of Dublin's best small hotels. The sunken lounge and communal breakfast are highlights, and you can check out more at number31.ie, the word number, and then the number31.ie to learn more about Number 31. All right. Well, we certainly hope you'll join us next time when we do part three of Best of the World, Where to Go in 2018, again from the December 2017, January 2018 issue of National Geographic Traveler. Now we're going to use our remaining time to check on our travel calendar from the January-February 2018 issue of AAA Go Magazine. It finally came in the mail just a couple of days ago. And we want to tell you about these events, which all take place in either North Carolina or South Carolina in January or February of 2018. Let's get started in January. January 9th, Derek Nelson and family, Givens Performing Arts Center in Pembroke, North Carolina. Siblings Derek, Rihanna, and Dalton have performed their pop folk harmony since childhood to raise money for music education. There is an entrance fee for this concert, and if you want more, check it out at uncp.edu, uncp.edu. Then move on to January 12th, Martha Washington Chautauqua History Alive Show. This is at the Headquarters Library in Spartanburg, South Carolina. Women of the American Revolution will be on stage. Hear how their courage influenced the revolution. It's all free, and you can check it out at GreenvilleChautauqua.org, C-H-A-U-T-A-U-Q-U-A, GreenvilleChautauqua.org. And then January 13th through 14th, we have the 237th anniversary of the Battle of Cowpens. This takes place Cowpens National Battlefield, Gaffney, South Carolina, and it features 18th century weapons firing, cavalry demonstrations, ranger-led battlefield walks, and more. And it's all free, so if you're interested in that sort of thing, this is a great place to go. You can learn more online at upcountrysc.com, upcountrysc.com/events, okay? And then we move on to January 17th and 18th, the South Carolina Agribiz and Farm Expo. This takes place at the Florence Civic Center in Florence, South Carolina, and that's just about a 2.5-hour drive from Raleigh. You can see all aspects of large and small agriculture, innovations, equipment, feedstocks, guest speakers, agricultural activities, and a whole lot more. It's all free. And you can check it out at scagribizexpo.com. SC Agri with a capital A, Biz with a capital B, Expo with a capital E, agribizexpo.com. And then from January 18th through the 21st, we head to Charleston's Jazz Festival. Multiple venues in downtown Charleston, 100 local, regional, and nationally recognized jazz musicians will be performing a wide range of styles. Again, that takes place from January the 18th through the 21st. It is a fee involved, so there must be tickets for sale. If you need to check it out, go to charlestonjazz.com/festival. charlestonjazz.com/festival. Then January 25th through the 28th, we head up to the western part of North Carolina for the Asheville Fringe Festival. Multiple locations throughout Asheville, drama to comedy and everything in between are going to be performed in a variety of venues. And it's a mix of both fees and free. So, you know, you could actually take in the free stuff and probably keep an eye on your budget. And you can check it all out at AshevilleFringe.org. That's Asheville Fringe, F-R-I-N-G-E, Asheville Fringe. .org. And finally, from January 26th through the 28th, the Wilmington Antique Show and Sale. It's Coastline Conference and Event Center in downtown Wilmington, and you can shop American and English furniture, vintage items, collectibles, and more. There is a fee to enter this, and it's at the WilmingtonAntiqueShow.com for more information. WilmingtonAntiqueShow.com for more information. Well, that's it for today's episode of Armchair Traveler. We hope you'll be listening next time, that you've enjoyed your journey today. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service, the content of our program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Comments and questions can be directed to 919-832-5138. Bye-bye.